Welcome to Byline. I'm Rick Helbert. Well, today is parking day around the world, where many people have turned metered parking spaces into temporary public parks to, in part, spur discussion about how cities use their public spaces. No one's favorite part of living in an urban area is finding a place to park your car, but a redesigned parking system in San Francisco may take the city one step towards a smarter, well-parked city. Here's independent radio producer Roman Mars.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. 99% of car trips in the U.S. end in a free parking space. But if there's one thing that urban planning and parking guru Donald Shoup wants you to understand, it's that so-called free parking is never free.
Every time you go to a grocery store or a movie theater or a restaurant, everything you do has a bit of the cost of parking embedded in it.
Everything except one thing.
Except in your role as driver.
In the suburban environment, free parking is a given. Having a massive tarmac that can comfortably fit a fleet of cars and also land a 747 is a huge part of the suburban landscape. But even in urban areas, we are subsidizing paid parking spaces because the rent on them is below market value. We also collectively pay for parking with time. Cruising for parking wastes time.
We've all done it. You go to a place and you see the price of off-street parking is maybe $5 an hour and it's 50 cents an hour on the street. Well, you'll circle the block until you see somebody going out.
Yeah, because parking in a lot is for quitters.
If you do it, everybody else is probably doing it and it all adds up.
Donald Shoup studied the amount of cruising for parking in a 15-block business district near UCLA and found that in a year, the vehicle miles traveled while cruising for parking was almost a million miles.
That's four trips to the moon or 36 trips around the earth.
Cruising for parking and double parking slows public transit, it endangers bicyclers and pedestrians, and that is happening everywhere.
Nobody has counted the costs of all this mismanagement of our car parking supply.
But San Francisco is looking to be the first major city to manage parking well.
My name is Jay Primus. I'm the manager of SF Park for the San Francisco MTA.
The new SF Park project uses sensors and networked meters to dynamically adjust parking prices over time. The key ingredient is the sensor, which sends back data about whether or not a car is actually there.
For the first time, we're going to know what's happening on the street.
And with that sensor data, the parking authority starts adjusting. The sensors give real-time data back to headquarters, and the new pricing is calibrated for the next month. It's demand-responsive pricing. Different times of the day may go up in price, and meters in less trafficked neighborhoods may go down to entice people to park there and walk a little farther. But this isn't just about parking. SF Park is about making a better designed city.
Lots of cities these days are interested in reducing greenhouse gas emissions and congestion. This is the first time that any city has tested out a parking-based approach to congestion management. That's good for people who drive, but it's really important for people who are on the bus and just trying to get home from work so that the bus is much faster, more reliable.
The goal is to have constant parking availability, one open space for every block so that people get in a space faster and aren't circling the block in their toxin-spewing death machines. And it's not just street parking. Pricing in the city-owned garages will also be dynamically adjusted, too.
There's no relation between the price of parking on-street at meters and parking in a lot or garage. In fact, it's usually more expensive to park in a parking lot or garage rather than at the meter, and that's just the opposite of how it should be. The plan is to change that relationship, make it cheaper to park in the lots and garages, to attract more people, just go straight to those lots and garages, keeping those on-street spaces available for those who really value them.
The thing that's been getting the most press about SF Park is all the data about parking availability that will be accessible by the public. And the image is some tech-savvy super user who is constantly checking their iPhone to find a parking space instead of watching where they're driving. Which, if you picture it for a second, is terrifying and would create more problems than it solves. But I think this is the wrong image. If successful, and it's a big if, and the market sets the right value for a parking space, you will never look for parking with your iPhone because, again, the goal is one open space per block, meaning there will always be parking available. There is no searching. The things you use your iPhone for is finding out how much it'll cost before you leave the house, where you can decide then if it's better to walk or ride the bus instead of drive. The key is that you don't have to know anything to have an easier time parking. Like the best design, it only works if you don't have to work to make it work. That made sense, right?
Robotics.
Thank you.
99% Invisible is produced by me, Roman Mars, with support from Lunar. It's a project of KALW, the American Institute of Architects San Francisco, and the Center for Architecture and Design. Find out more at 99percentinvisible.org.
This is Byline on WFPL. It was the summer of 1966 when a persistent 17-year-old with a high school radio show near Chicago got the interview of a lifetime, Muhammad Ali. But only a handful of people ever got to hear this time capsule until now. Here it is.
This is Muhammad Ali, the heavyweight champion of the world, down at the lunar station Cape Kennedy on the way to Mars.
This is Blank on Blank. I'm David Gerlach. And in this edition, a vintage interview with Muhammad Ali that we've just uncovered. It was recorded back in 1966 by a teenager from suburban Chicago. Few people heard it back then, but now, almost 50 years later, Michael Eisner has dusted it off, and he's going to take us back to that day on the south side of Chicago when he got the interview of a lifetime.
I was probably 9 years old when I first realized how much I loved radio. And then I had an opportunity to get into New Trier High School in Winnetka, Illinois, and they had a radio station there. And we called up out of nowhere celebrities that were in town in Chicago.
Hello, this is Muhammad Ali, the heavyweight champion of the world. I will be speaking to you soon on WNTH 88.1 FM in Winnetka.
Okay, so we're 17 years old, we're sitting in the office, and Ali screeches up in his red Cadillac convertible right in front of a fire plug, 24 years old, and comes in the office, and this girl comes and sits on his lap. She must have been 18, 19 years old, and he starts doing this riff. And it is this bizarre scenario that he created of him going to Mars and fighting the champion up on Mars.
We have to stop at about 10 space stations on the way. We estimate our time at getting there in about 10 years. 1976. I'll be 10 years older, but I will still be in good shape. I expect the fight to go about 12 seconds. I'm fighting the green giant up there named Pelisi Kawaka. And after knocking him out, I hope to be back on Earth at about 1986.
You know, I have this microphone in front of this guy who's one of the most famous people on Earth. And we start to ask him questions.
Okay, Muhammad Ali, how did you first become interested in boxing?
Well, I started about 12 years ago. Someone stole my bicycle, and I said, I'm going to learn how to fight so I can catch him and beat him up. But I never did catch him. But I ended up the champ of the whole world.
Was there any particular boxer that you really idolized before you became a pro?
Yeah, Sugar Ray Robinson was my idol, and he still, I think, is the greatest of all times.
Mm-hmm. Did you resent that hard training that you had to go through before major bouts?
No, I didn't. I never have really resented hard work because I've always liked it. Up every morning for road work, going to the gymnasium every day at 12 o'clock. I never changed my pattern.
Why did you feel that you had to campaign for your first fight with Sonny Liston?
Well, there were so many fellas ranked over me, I couldn't just whip them all. So I had to outshadow them by talking. And it made me a bigger drawing card, so the promoters wanted me instead of the rest. It gave me a quicker shot at the title.
Mr. Ali, what in your estimation is the future of boxing today?
Well, if the boxers are a little more colorful, talked a little like I did, and just do as half as much as I did for boxing, it will be all right.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much.
You know, I guess if I have any regrets at all, it's that I didn't get him to somehow spit his gum out during the interview.
So I hope that all of you will be here waiting for me and tell your children that the champion is leaving now and I will be back in 20 years with the Universal title. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Michael Eisner for sharing his interview with Muhammad Ali. Amy Dravzowska helped produce this Blank on Blank with me. And please check out the animated video version of this interview that we created. It's at blankonblank.org. Blank on Blank is distributed by the Public Radio Exchange. I'm David Gerlach. Keep listening.
When we come back, a visit to Louisville's Idea Festival with blogger Melissa Chipman. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Heldet. We are marking parking day here at WFPL. For technical purposes, we have moved into our studio. We're going to switch gears here and talk about the Idea Festival, which is underway, of course, here in Louisville this week. Its organizers describe it as a celebration for the intellectually curious. And again, this year, there's no shortage of topics of discussion. Joining us to talk about the 2012 Idea Festival is Melissa Chipman. Among other things, she's the creator and publisher of Louisville.com, which celebrates Louisville's culture and character. And this week, Melissa is blogging for WFPL about the Idea Festival, where she has been immersed in it since it began this week. Melissa, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So much to take in, I assume, in so little time.
It is. Idea Festival is probably my favorite time of year here in Louisville. And for the past, I think, 3 years, I've actually taken time off of work to attend the entire event. Starts in real for about on Thursday around 9 o'clock in the morning and runs until 5 o'clock on Saturday afternoon, and there are about 6 or 7 speakers per day. So wow. It's a lot to take in.
Well, let's talk about a few of the folks that you've seen so far. You've Peter Sims. Talk about his book Little Bets.
Yeah, Peter Sims is an entrepreneur and a best-selling author, and his book Little Bets is basically a book for entrepreneurs about how risk-averse we've become lately. And especially because of the American education system, we tend to punish kids for doing things that aren't quite perfect. A later speaker during that day said that 2/3 of American college students earn A's and B's. And that's because of grade inflation, because we're so afraid of letting our kids yeah. fail. So he suggests that entrepreneurs and in the workplace and even in the schools, that people take a series of little bets at the beginning of any venture, that they, practice sustainable losses. So it's kind of a trial and error process of getting a business started. And once you figure out what works and what doesn't work, and that's when you lay your big money down. So you may try and fail 100 times, but on the 101st time, that's when you put all your money down and it's going to be truly successful because you've gone through the trial and error sessions.
Interesting stuff. You've also sat in on a session with David Kaiser, which is interesting.
David Kaiser is a historian of science, and he just recently published a book called How the Hippies Saved Physics. That name comes from the Thomas Cahill book that was published back in the 1980s called How the Irish Saved Civilization. After World War II, there was a real big boom in the physics in physics majors, and largely most of that was due to the defense industry, and they needed a lot of physicists. But in the mid-70s, that totally bust, that bubble burst, mm-hmm. And suddenly we had all of these kids graduating from the greatest institutions in America, MIT, Caltech, Stanford, with physics degrees, and suddenly no jobs for them. So a bunch of them ended up in the Berkeley area in San Francisco in the mid-1970s during kind of the height of the psychedelic sort of era. Yeah. And these people were highly trained in quantum physics, which is a much more theoretical, not a practical part of physics. And they ended up getting snatched up by the sort of weird science that was becoming kind of popularized during the 1970s, the very hip sort of with it science, which were experiments with psychotropic drugs. If you've ever watched the movie The Men Who Stared at Goats, yeah. this idea of like mind reading and stuff. And so they became counterculture darlings and, were at the forefront of a lot of these more experimental physics projects.
We're talking with Melissa Chipman, who is blogging from the Idea Festival for WFPL. The festival got underway yesterday, I guess, and will continue through Saturday?
Yes.
Can people still get in? Are there any sessions people can get in on?
Chris Kimmel, who is the organizer of Idea Festival, just announced a couple hours ago that there are still single tickets available for certain events. There weren't as of yesterday, but a lot of companies who bought up bulk tickets are now donating those tickets back. So if you go to the box office, you should be able to get a ticket for almost any event at this point.
Let's talk about one other session that you sat in on, because one of the early employees of Facebook was a speaker.
Yeah, Kevin Colleran. He was the seventh employee at Facebook. Mm. He was so interesting. He looks incredibly young. He probably looks younger than he actually is. But he joined Facebook 6 years ago, and he was hired virtually. He was hired over the internet. So he didn't at first meet Mark Zuckerberg and the West Coast crew. And he became their first advertising executive. And his presentation was like essentially a sales pitch for Facebook. I'm not really sure what his big idea for Idea Festival was, except for like Facebook is really, really cool. His apartment in New York became the East Coast headquarters of Facebook, and it was a tiny apartment, and the HR director at Facebook had to send him like those minimum wage posters and those like workplace safety posters to hang in his living room. But he left the company about a year ago, and at the time that he left, he was the second longest tenured employee of Facebook after Mark Zuckerberg.
Wow. Just about 30 seconds or so left. What's the next big thing that's coming up that you're really looking forward to?
Well, I'm currently missing Baratunde Thurston, who's a comic, and I just published a great book called How to Be Black. The good news is that he is actually coming to speak at my local book club at 5 o'clock, and he is opening that event at 6 o'clock to the public, and that's going to be at Rye in the Patio. So if you want to come and meet and have bourbon with Baratunde Thurston, you can come to Rye at 6 p.m.
Always an interesting time during the Idea Festival.
Sure
Melissa
is.
Chipman is blogging from the festival for WFPL. Her blog is louisville.com. Melissa, thanks for joining us, and enjoy the rest of the festival.
Thanks for having me.
This is Byline on WFPL. With universities under siege financially and conceptually, what will the future of higher education look like? Richard DeMillo is a professor at Georgia Tech and has written a new book exploring this topic. It's called Abelard to Apple, The Fate of American Colleges and Universities. He was part of the Idea Festival this week, and he spoke with WFPL Morning Edition host Jonathan Bastian.
As we were just talking about together here, I mentioned the cover of the New York Times Magazine. I mentioned Newsweek. It seems like everywhere we look right now, this issue of universities going through massive changes, or some people would say almost on the verge of collapsing or changing. And it's a complicated topic, but how do you diagnose what's going on right now?
Well, there's certainly a fear aspect of this. People are running towards models that they think are more financially attractive. But actually, the situation is pretty simple. And let's put the private universities aside right now. There's a separate set of conversations about privates. Public universities are losing state support, hand over fist, if that's a metaphor I can use. And they're not shedding missions. So over the last generation, universities that get most of their support from state and local governments have built their football programs. They've built performing arts studios. They have climbing walls for students. They have fancy dormitories. They've pursued laboratories that are more suitable to large research institutions. And that's all been subsidized by increasing state support. Well, at the time that support is increasing, that's fine. But now we're seeing that support drop. And instead of getting rid of some of those programs, what they're doing is taking value away from undergraduates. They're taking value away from academic programs. And the only way to maintain a limited level of quality is to increase the only other revenue source that's available to them. That's tuition. And whenever you have that kind of situation, you wonder, where is the value gone? Are students going to actually be paying for value? The American public has picked up on this fact. And for the first time, we're seeing the majority of the American public questioning the value of that tuition dollar.
I mean, does it appear to you that that students can pick up that burden? They can take on that new financial responsibility of paying their way through college? Or is the answer right now no, that we are really struggling with this from the students' perspective?
No, it's not. It's not sustainable. In good times, in historical terms, tuition goes up at universities across the whole range of 4,000 universities at about twice the rate of inflation. That's a long term trend, and this year, last year, we saw huge tuition spikes, and for the first time, students that are taking out loans to go to college are finding themselves unable to pay the loans when they graduate. So you see large tuition spikes. You see large default rates on the parts of students. That's not a sustainable situation. We saw that in the housing crisis. This is that kind of bubble.
Yeah, I just think it's such a fascinating topic because then it begins to make us think about what is the university for also right now. I mean, there's an attack a lot of people think on the humanities because, look, if we're going to fork over at a liberal arts college, let's say $50,000 a year, English and philosophy aren't exactly the number one things you want to study. It seems that now there's an emphasis on math, business, science, things of that nature, and we seem to be fragmenting the two right now.
And it's a serious situation, and it causes a lot of friction on college campuses. On my own campus, the discussion, I think, is less severe because we're a technological university.
And you're at Georgia Tech.
People come to Georgia Tech either on the faculty or as students expecting that they're going to be steeped in this culture. But I know at other institutions, large public institutions, you find the humanities faculty circling the wagons, so to speak. There have been some studies that say that as valuable as philosophy and English are, we just aren't doing it very well. We're not teaching undergraduates to read critically, to acquire those skills that you would expect from a general education. First 2 years of college, which kind of undercuts the value argument. So you see in the STEM disciplines, science, technology, engineering, math, a big emphasis on value.
Yeah.
Where do you get a job? What do you earn? On the humanities, it's harder to make that argument.
So then how does this issue of the technology factor in? Because you look at some of the top universities, Yale, MIT, Harvard, they're almost creating these digital global brands right now with giving out all this technology worldwide, putting their courses up online. To begin with, why are they doing this?
They're responding to the market. Pure and simple. When you get entrenched institutions, incumbents is what we call them, that are not responsive to market forces, markets are very smart, and markets build bypass economies. And what you saw with Khan Academy, which was really one of the first experiments in this area, just a guy in Silicon Valley who wanted to teach his cousins online how to pass calculus.
That's right. Yeah.
Became a runaway internet hit. And people flocked to it. Why did they flock to it? Because they were destroying traditional boundaries. They were building bypasses around the incumbents. Well, as soon as you have the 20 top universities in the world saying, you know what, we get that. We're going to put our material online for anyone that wants to learn, and we'll figure out how to connect in better ways with those students as we go along. That's a pretty impressive bypass. I mean, that's not a bypass road. That's a bypass freeway.
Because a big part of this book is also talking about this issue of how can universities figure out what they care about, what they do best, what are ways they can differentiate themselves? Because earlier you mentioned there is this the middle universities who you think are going to have to really, really, really make some changes. Talk a little bit about that.
Right. So those are the institutions that have survived on a Me Too mode for many, many years. If you're a public institution, then you want to be more like the University of Michigan. If you're a private institution, you want to be like Harvard or Princeton or maybe Williams College. If you're a technological university, you want to be like MIT. So when you read the strategic plans for these universities, you get kind of a funny feeling that I've read this before. And you have, because every university in the middle has the same strategic goals. They want to empower students. They want to create lifelong learners. Whatever it turns out to be, it's a bunch of pre-digested stuff that goes into the plans. And when you're paying $5,000 a semester, that's one thing. When you're paying $20,000 a semester, I think you want a little sharper you know, response to your question, what do you do? What do you do well? And they've gotten used to not delivering that. I think universities have to discover what their roots are, not change who they are, discover what they are, why they started out to begin with, and retreat to those roots before they start building up big expensive programs.
Richard DeMillo is the author of Abelard to Apple, The Fate of American Colleges and Universities. Richard, thanks again.
Thank you, Jonathan.
And indeed, that was Richard DeMillo in conversation with WFPL Morning Edition host Jonathan Bastian. DeMillo spoke to a sold-out audience yesterday at the Idea Festival here in Louisville. This is Byline on WFPL, and we're going to stick to an education theme, but bring it here to Jefferson County Public Schools. Devin Katayama joins us to talk about some developments, including a debate this week here on WFPL, and of course a big state Supreme Court ruling regarding the JCPS student assignment plan. Devin, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Well, of course, there are three open seats on the Jefferson County School Board in the race in November, and this high court decision that upheld the student assignment plan is, of course, going to come into play in the campaigning from here on out.
Yeah, and as we've been reporting, nearly half of the 15 candidates vying for one of the three seats are against the student assignment plan in some way. Now, that idea of neighborhood schools and what that is, how that's actually defined, was brought up at the District 2 debate. And the District 2 debate was held this Tuesday with the four candidates, Elizabeth Burfield, Phil Hamming, David Jones Jr., and George Tallhurst. It was really what I really enjoyed about this debate was that each of the candidates was so diverse in their thinking, in their age, in their views of basically, you know, how the district can get better, which is exactly what people all along have been saying they wanted to see. So I think at least in District 2, the residents there have a good range to choose from.
District 2, whose seat is this? Who holds it currently?
Steve Imhoff currently holds it. He actually showed up for a little bit during the debates, which was nice to see.
And he is one of three candidates not seeking re-election.
The retiring.
The others being Hardesty and
Larry Hujo. Yeah.
We'll talk about that in a little bit. And we'll get into detail about the Supreme Court ruling, but let's talk about the debate a little bit and some of the candidates. I'll let you just kind of go down the list and maybe give a highlight.
Sure. As I said, there's a wide range of opinion. George Tallhurst is probably the one who stuck to the guns the most about the neighborhood schools issue. He's been around the district for a long time, had, I believe, grandkids in the district. He's an older gentleman, and here he is explaining that it's essentially the number one issue affecting student assignment.
We need to have smaller neighborhood schools. We need to eliminate the busing completely. We can take and have the children go to the schools in their neighborhood or schools of choice, but let their parents be responsible for getting them there, either by bike, walking, TARC, carpool, volunteers. But it can happen again. We don't have to build all new schools. We don't have to build no more centralized monstrosities where the students don't know each other, where the faculty don't know the students, and et cetera. We need to build comfortable settings, not build, but set up comfortable settings. And we can use a variety of different things. But the most important thing I'd have to do is work with the school board, because not one of us can do anything by ourselves.
Now, Mr. Tallhurst did recognize that neighborhood schools likely won't happen for a long time, but he's still very much part of his campaign. Phil Hamming, another candidate that's running heavily on the idea of neighborhood schools, or at least offering a choice of neighborhood schools to parents. He did at one point say that middle and high schools might not, you know, be in that same category, that the focus is really on younger kids, elementary school kids. And here he is explaining the importance of keeping younger students closer to home.
If nothing else, we should limit this practice to only middle schoolers and high schoolers. If diversity is only achievable in that regard, then fine. But to put a kindergartner or a first grader or a second grader on a bus and send them across town in the interest of somebody else's agenda does not serve their educational needs, and we need to prepare them better at the kindergarten, first grade, and second grade level at their own neighborhood school before we send them out into the community at large to get the rest of their education.
And Mr. Hamming was also saying that keeping them in their neighborhood was essentially allow parents to be more active in their community and in their child's education. Now, Elizabeth Burfield, she took more of a centrist approach. She definitely thought that diversity should be in her child's school. She says that, in fact, that it should be mandated, but she's open to listening to the neighborhood school's idea, but that maybe, again, just like Mr. Hamming, maybe it should be limited to just the younger children.
I think keeping younger children closer to home is a good idea, having a local option, not necessarily. I don't think anyone can guarantee that any child is going to be able to get into any school, partially because of what Mr. Jones said about population changes and school capacity. But, you know, when we talk about older grades, middle school and high school, I don't see how a neighborhood middle school or high school in every neighborhood is feasible. The resources required to staff, to provide extracurricular activities, athletics for a middle or high school school is just it's just not possible, I think, at, you know, a neighborhood level. I think by the time students reach those older grades, parents are looking for schools that best fit their children's ambitions and their attributes, their talents, and probably are willing to travel a little bit farther.
And you heard Ms. Burfield there talking a little bit about the resources and perhaps the difficulties that the district might have if they go back to neighborhood schools. That's also something that David Jones Jr. brought up. He also brought up that it may lead to overcrowding, additional schools may be needed. And then Phil Hamming said that there may already be some buildings that may be empty to which they could use. So, but it's really unclear, you know, whether we could resort back to neighborhood schools in the first place. I mean, board members earlier this year said that there's no way they could should the state Supreme Court rule against them in the decision that came in this week.
And not everyone would want to go to their neighborhood school.
Correct, and not everyone would want to go to their neighborhood school.
So one more candidate here, David Jones?
Yeah, and David Jones, he's probably one of the most well-known candidates in the community. His name has been out there for some time. He's probably one of the more wealthy candidates. Some of the other candidates actually questioned his previous work, like his former position as the board chair of Humana and his relationships with the mayor and the backing from the teachers union, which, you know, he didn't solicit, but they still did back him. And that's always been a questionable thing in this community. But he says here that he will not be a voice for these supporters.
You're not going to find anybody that said I was a rubber stamp for anybody. You know, I am always focused on whatever the mission is of the organization. And all boards have to deal with some mix of individual agendas and, you know, legacy problems and sacred cows and dreamy future, and find somewhere in there the core of reality that you can actually get behind and spend your money on and affect. So the experience, I think, of working through the strange role of a board member who is not a member of management, not a hands-on full-time person, but in this case, really kind of a civic volunteer, I think the experience will be helpful there. Otherwise, I mean, with respect to the teacher support, you know, I want to just say very directly, I am very pleased and gratified that the teachers union chose to endorse me. Of course, I'm thrilled that the mayor and the lieutenant governor and Steve Imhoff and a lot of others have. But I don't think very many people are going to take seriously the idea that I am a tool of the teachers union.
I also asked the candidates about student achievement and a number of other issues. You can find the complete debate on our website at WFPL.org. Search on Jefferson County or JCPS debates. But another main issue I just wanted to run down really quickly was the idea of student achievement. Obviously, for the neighborhood schools folks, they think that student achievement could definitely benefit from the neighborhood schools. They also talked a lot about the idea of redirecting some of the budget where they could find costs to poorer schools, in instances of, you know, maybe even incentives. At one point, Phil Hamming said to provide better teachers to be able, you know, some incentive to go into those schools. Burfield said that she'd like to see the focus on some of the critical thinking skills, not just the core common or the common core skills which were implemented, which is actually part of the new accountability system in Kentucky.
So we have two more debates here scheduled here at
WFPL.
Yeah,
next Tuesday and then the following Tuesday. It'll be District 4 and 7 with respect to those dates at 6:30.
And we've got about a minute left. The big Supreme Court ruling came down, state Supreme Court ruling, and it really came down to an argument over the meaning of the words enroll and attend, and the high court said just because you can enroll in the school closest to your home doesn't mean you can attend.
Right, and it was a 5-2 decision, so there were two dissenting judges, Justices Daniel Venters and Bill Cunningham. In the dissent, they write, would anyone really believe that if a boy enrolled in Boy Scout Troop 79 would not become a member of Troop 79? They later say that the school board's "you can enroll but you cannot attend" interpretation, which was adopted by the majority, would be more credible in the surrealistic world of the Eagle Song Hotel California, where you can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave. So there was some disagreement there.
I don't know if that song's ever been cited in a Supreme Court ruling.
I don't know.
There's a first for everything.
Right.
Devin Katayama covers education issues for WFPL. Devin, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rick.
We'll be back with more in a moment. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Helder. We are marking Parking Day today. This is the day where you can transform a parking space into a temporary public park, and we've done so in front of our building at 619 South 4th Street. We were broadcasting live, but due to technical issues, we moved indoors, but our space is still open. You can come by and record some comments. We'll ask you some random questions. You can share some thoughts with us. We're going to put them all together and post them online, and we're going to have a sample of those that we got this morning at the end of this program. Louisville lays claim to many unique inventions, chewing gum, the Happy Birthday song, and the cheeseburger, among others. But in a new occasional series called You Again, WFPL's Devin Katayama and Gabe Bullard look at another innovation that came out of our city.
It's You Again. I'm Gabe Bullard.
And I'm Devin Katayama.
And movies were invented in Louisville. Well, that's not really the case, but one crucial aspect of the movie industry did come about here.
And that's essentially this idea of the blockbuster video.
Yeah, the video chain.
not the video chain.
The blockbuster as in the line around the corner.
Right, and that came with Jaws, the movie Jaws, is that what?
It was Jaws in the 70s is when people started saying that, but it happened in Louisville about 130 years earlier. Fred Miller is an artist and writer here in Louisville, and he has been doing some research and writing on this guy, John Banvard?
Banvard. It's actually originally from Bonnevard. They were French Huguenots. It's not a very common name still.
Who was this guy?
He was an American painter, originally from New York, a big family. His father was an architect. He had a construction business. And he came to Louisville in his teens.
Banvard showed this interest in theater and arts, and he eventually got a job on a traveling showboat on the river.
Chapman's Showboat. He was an actor. He painted sets and did all kinds of things and went to Paducah for a while. There was this whole class back then of itinerant players who just sort of bumped around because the little river towns, they couldn't support their own theater. But if people dropped in on a boat, people would splurge and come out to see them.
And that's the start where we see in Banvard's career that he is looking at the river and he is looking at art.
The Mississippi River at that time was just such a cultural boundary. You know, people had crossed it, but it was still, like, mentally, in the imagination, it was the borderline of the Western frontier.
So Banvard went to the Mississippi River, traveled up and down it, slept underneath the canoe with a rifle, was hunting his food, and began making sketches.
When he finished his trip, Banvard set up in a workshop in Louisville, and he started painting. And he painted what ended up becoming a panorama. It's a precursor to the movies, pretty much. It's a canvas, a very long canvas that scrolled, and Banvard would give a lecture, and piano music would play behind it.
Drawing in the Scientific American of how he displayed it with the upright spools that cranked it, and then he had to have something that would hold the top edge of the painting up in the middle so it didn't sag. There were rows of pulleys, and there was a rope sewn to the top of the painting that ran between the pulleys so he kept it upright and turning. It was called the 3-mile painting, but it was actually originally about a quarter of a mile long, but he was trying to paint something like 3,000 miles of river.
How tall was it?
It was 12 feet tall.
So it's just a long, long, long canvas.
Yes.
Painted, and it would scroll from left to right when people went to watch these panoramas.
And then from right to left when the next group of people came. He didn't rewind it. He just did the trip backwards.
So this thing is essentially like the movies, their version of the movies. John booked a theater to give his lecture and roll this big canvas.
What happens?
Opening night was Monday. It was June 29, 1846. It rained and nobody came. There was a notice in the paper. You can go find the newspaper, that the Morning Courier, the Louisville Morning Courier, and it introduces this thing as this Banvard's Leviathan painting, wonder of the world, the greatest achievement of individual enterprise on record. And nobody came. But the next day, he went to the docks and he gave out free tickets, and then he built up some word of mouth. I think his first paying audience, he made $10, which was not bad.
Yeah, pretty good back then.
Yeah.
I'm still trying to get a sense of what this is like. If I go down there and I pay my, what is it, a pen? What do they used to call money back then?
I think it was actually...
money? All right, I pay my money.
Your half penny?
I pay my half penny.
I think it was actually 50 cents.
50
I think
cents.
The admission Ooh. Was 50 okay. cents. Less for kids, I
Okay.
think.
Yeah. So I sit down on a grass slab or whatever they have there? Or
no, this was in a building called the Apollo Saloon. Or sometimes they called it the Apollo Rooms, which I think if they were doing a classier sort of entertainment. And so there was seating, and there would be a big crowd, and Banvard was there with this giant painting, and it, I don't know, I imagine it must have creaked. And then pretty soon, it was just packed. And there are ongoing notices in the paper of, once again, it's crammed and jammed. Everybody's coming out to see this painting.
And these audiences, this was really the first big blockbuster.
Yes. Yes, exactly. This is the first blockbuster motion picture.
And this ended up being a really big hit. Word started spreading around about it. Extra trains were running into Louisville, apparently, to bring people to see this thing.
The Guinness Book of World Records actually even mentioned it. And John didn't invent the panorama, but he was one of the first to make it really big and to make an event out of the panorama.
And there were a lot of panoramas back then after he established them as a popular form.
Banvard started touring with this. He went to Boston. He went to New York. He went overseas. He had a string of shows in England. And he was this American icon, the most famous artist in the world, perhaps. Likely the first millionaire artist. He performed for the Queen. Charles Dickens saw his performances. And with this money, as other people were doing panoramas, he started traveling the world. He collected artifacts. He built a huge mansion, all from the panorama.
What's interesting, though, is that this did kickstart the whole idea of movies and the idea of picture shows, but it really faded quickly.
The medium just died out. It's just sort of a forgotten phenomenon. There were other panoramas. Other people started doing them after he found this audience for the thing. They were extremely lucrative.
So what happened to Banvard? It seems like his fortunes changed pretty significantly as the panorama as an entertainment or artistic medium died out. History shows that he started a museum with all of these artifacts he had, but the last we know of this man who was once the most respected and the wealthiest artist in the world is that he died penniless and forgotten in the Dakota Territories.
The short answer to what happened to him is he founded a museum in New York, he got into competition with P.T. Barnum, and he lost. ¶¶
That was WFPL's Gabe Bullard and Devin Katayama talking to Fred Miller. Another version of this story was printed in the paper. The music was performed by Raphael Cho. You can hear this story again on WFPL. Search on You Again. You're listening to Byline on 89.3 WFPL. A reminder that you're invited to join us for the forums featuring the Jefferson County School Board candidates. We've had one this week featuring the District 2 candidates, and we're going to have two more forums because two more seats are open, Districts 4 and 7. And we're going to have those debates here at WFPL on the next consecutive Tuesdays at 6:30 p.m. We'll talk to the candidates about the student assignment plan and other issues in our series of debates. For more information, visit our website, WFPL, and search on JCPS 2012 Debates. Well, we've been collecting your responses to our random questions as we mark Parking Day here at WFPL. We've transformed a parking space in front of our building into a green space, a temporary public park. We've been talking to some of the folks passing by and asking them questions and putting together their responses. We're going to put all the responses together on our website soon, but we've cobbled together some of those from this morning, and here's a sampling of that.
What's your name?
Tracy.
You'll have 15 seconds to answer.
Okay.
When were you the most afraid in your life?
Oh, wow. When I had a cyst on my thyroid and they told me right before the 4th of July weekend that it was a possibility it could be cancer.
What is your favorite word?
Love.
What quality about yourself would you never change?
I think I would never change my height. I've gotten used to being this tall.
What's the most painful thing you've ever felt?
Tooth extraction.
Sing your favorite song.
Sing my favorite song. How about my favorite song is this, because it's on my favorite day, which is my birthday. So happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Kelly. Happy birthday to you. How about that?
And what time did you wake up this morning and why?
5:30 and to come to work.
4 o'clock to come to work.
And describe your favorite food.
Oh, that's hard. My favorite food I discovered recently is a squash called Delicata squash.
What quality would you never change about yourself?
Being happy.
When were you happiest in your life?
Probably when I was born.
Man, the happiest in my life. Beautiful. I was in the Navy in Thailand. While we were in Thailand, it was this, I can't say it on air, it was a beautiful time in Thailand, on the beach. Yeah, Australia too. I'm going to go to Australia.
All right, let's mix it up a little bit.
Can you say your name for us?
Hi, I'm Laura.
Laura, how many chapters are there in your life? Please give us a number. And what chapter are you in now? And does this chapter have a title?
Oh, there's at least 372 chapters, and this chapter is chapter 14, and it's how can I get my children to stop staying home and living with me.
What's the worst sound you have ever heard?
I'm from Nebraska, and I was at the first Big 12 championship game, and I was sitting in front of a Texas fan who was banging on a cowbell for, like, the entire game while we were losing the first Big 12 championship game and losing the chance to go to the national championship. Worst sound ever.
What is your least favorite smell?
Underarms.
What is your favorite place in Louisville and why?
There's so many great places in Louisville. I think I have to say Waterfront Park, though.
The most physically painful thing I could say I felt is when I was about 8 years old, I fell in a tree.
Check, check. 1, 2, 3.
That's perfect. All right. What quality would you never change about yourself?
Integrity.
Character.
Would you rather be invisible or be able to fly?
Invisible.
Why?
Because I can watch people having sex.
Thank you. And in 15 seconds, sing your favorite song.
Okay, 15 seconds. Okay. I really love you, baby. I love what you got. Let's get together, baby, we can. Get hot. No more tomorrow, baby. Time is today. Girl, I can make you feel.
That's all the time we have for Dime Byline today. Byline is produced by the WFPL News staff. Our production team led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. Thanks to everyone involved in our Parking Day event today. And come by and see our temporary park at 619 South 4th Street. I'm Rick Howlett. Have a great weekend.